Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Happy New Year. It's like a little bit like the tundra outside, I guess. It's supposed to be like 15 below last night or something, so I guess some people are still thawing out under the warm covers at home, so I don't blame them. New Year's is a time that we often reflect on what's transpired in our lives in the past year, and you think of aspirations we have for the coming year. And it's something that's a communal time that we do this, that we all take stock of what's going on in our lives, what's past and what's coming up. And it's kind of something we do collectively in our society and globally even, that it's a shared experience we all have. This morning, I'd like to talk a little bit about when we take stock of ourselves as individuals in our solitude, in the course of living our lives. That although we're all here together, that so much of our life, of how our life goes, depends on our individual effort and how we choose to act upon the circumstances that arise in our lives, the things that come up to challenge us. In Buddhism, we can reflect on Shakyamuni Buddha's foundational teachings of the Four Noble Truths and to see if they can help guide us in our lives. Each of us needs to look at these principles and decide for ourselves whether they're useful to us. And I wanted to talk a little about the Four Noble Truths in our lives. So the first Noble Truth is dukkha, which is often translated as suffering. And it literally means a wheel out of kilter, or simply crookedness or misalignment. When our lives are out of balance, it's difficult to be upright. The cause of this crookedness is our attachment and desire for things. We often say, getting what we don't want, not getting what we want, and the suffering caused by physical pain and illness. This is the second noble truth. So I have a little story I experienced over Labor Day this year that my husband Dwayne and I went up to Camp Unistar in northern Minnesota, which is on Cass Lake, and it's a place where the Unitarians go, the adults go, for summer camp. And so we were actually there on their closing weekend to help them close up. And I've never been able to get up there with him, but he's always talked about how beautiful it is, and he really loves going there. Kind of the same way many of us like going down to Hokkyoji. So I finally had the opportunity to go with him. And so one of the mornings we took a walk before breakfast, and that I knew that they had said at breakfast time the meal was going to be eggs and fried potatoes, and it sounded really, really good. And so Dwayne and I were taking a walk, and our walk got longer and longer, and I was like, well, Dwayne, maybe we should get back for breakfast. And so when we finally got back to the dining hall for breakfast, that most of the food was already gone. And I started pouting. I wanted those eggs and potatoes. A couple of you have heard this story before. I told this story in this class I was teaching here. So I wanted those eggs and potatoes, and I was watching myself pout and looking at how ridiculous I was, and being so upset because I didn't get these eggs and potatoes, that I didn't get what I wanted. And then, so what was left over was this pot of oatmeal on the counter. And at first it was like, ugh, so I was going to get what I didn't want. So then the third noble truth comes into play, that there is an opportunity to straighten up from crookedness and to experience well-being in our lives. This is called sukha. And this can happen to each of us when each of us makes the effort and commits to live our lives with integrity. So there I was looking at this pot of oatmeal. And I looked at it and I said, you know what? I really do like oatmeal. It looks really good and warm and creamy and delicious. And so then I took a bowl of oatmeal and I really enjoyed it. So then the fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path, which includes right view, right intention, speech, action, livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness or awareness, and right concentration or meditation. And I'd like to continue to concentrate on right effort this morning. That Shakyamuni Buddha addressed some of his disciples about right effort. And this passage is from the Nikayas, which are his discourses from the Pali Canon. And I got it out of this book that's called In the Buddha's Words. And it's a summation of many of his discourses that are kind of put in subject order. So it's kind of a nice book. So he says, and what, monks, is right effort? Here, monks, a monk generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome states. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, unwholesome states. He generates desire for the continuation of arisen, wholesome states, for their non-decline, increase, and increase. In expansion and fulfillment by development, he makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. Now, some of you might be saying, what the hell did she just say there? So, let me decipher this for you. So, in other words, we should try not to create unwholesomeness in our lives. If it already exists, it would be beneficial to be a way to step away from it. We should try to cultivate wholesomeness, and if we're already doing good things, we should just keep doing them. This sounds like some pretty good New Year's resolutions to me. It's just the beginning of the year. Let's try it. So, yeah. The thing is, although we could get encouragement from others to be wholesome, ultimately the buck stops here. So, are we willing to scrutinize our lives and put effort into cultivating wholesomeness? If we make the effort to be on the Buddhist path by meditating and making a commitment to have the Four Noble Truths inform our lives when difficulties come up, which they always will, we all know that difficulties are always there for us, we can conduct ourselves with a more balanced response to them than we might have if we weren't practicing. Training our hearts and minds to do the best we can to be upright. I'm not saying that the suffering will completely go away. It probably will never completely disappear. But being aware of our behavior in the midst of deep anguish will somehow help us face that anguish and ultimately be able to move on more fluidly. This is the human condition, really beyond Buddhism even. So Buddhism's just a particular way to guide us through our lives. So I've been leading a study group at the Unitarian First Universalist Church, where we've been reading Sailing Home by Norm Fisher. This is a wonderful book. And Norm is a former abbot at San Francisco Zen Center, and he was around Zen Center, or he still is a little bit, from the early 60s. And he did something novel that he said that most people seem to, who have been abbot or senior students around San Francisco Zen Center, seem to retire to Green Gulch Farm. But Norm decided, I'm retiring and moving on from this place. And so he created another group called Everyday Zen. And he has groups all over the country. And he's got lots of very good practical things to say. And I suggest Googling him if you'd like. So this book, Sailing Home, is Norm's Zen perspective on Homer's Odyssey. And he talks about the metaphor of Homer's Odyssey and how important it is to our lives. And he had given a series of talks about this, and people encouraged him to make it into a book. But he felt that Westerners might relate better to Homer's Odyssey than some of these ancient Chinese and Japanese texts, with people wandering around the mountainside and who knows what. Although I guess a lot of us don't go sailing all over the world in a boat, but still there's something about this and from the foundation of Western culture that we can relate to in the Odyssey. So that the book begins with Telemachus, Odysseus' son, who is on the cusp of adulthood, being urged to stand up for what was rightfully his. Until this time, he was kind of in a holding pattern. He was stuck. He didn't have the energy to stand up for himself or his mother. That he was 20 years old, and Odysseus had left the household when he was a baby to go fight in Troy. And Odysseus was fought for 10 years in Troy and then was on his way home. And it took him a long time to get home. So Telemachus never really had his father at home to guide him. And so he didn't know which way to go, and all these suitors who wanted to marry his mother had overrun the household, and they were consuming all the household goods, all the food, and creating chaos and a mess in the household, and he didn't know what to do, and he was just in despair. But then the goddess Athena, who was disguised as a fellow named Mentor, came to help him get unstuck, to urge him on, to give him a nudge, and to give him confidence that he could stand up for himself. So Telemachus got up in front of all these suitors and people who were overrunning his house and said what he felt, and he expressed his grief, and he said who he was, and he was trying to take his place as the head of this household. And he did what was important for him to do, whether or not these guys were listening to him. or not. So that Athena helped as mentor, Mentis helped him leave in the dark of night to go on a journey to find out what happened to his father. And it was an important step for him to be able to resolve this, because everybody was in this holding pattern because nobody knew what happened to Odysseus. He had been gone so long, for almost 20 years. So he went on his journey, and he didn't know where it was going to take him. He was completely open to see what was going to happen in his life. So I think we often all find ourselves in this situation in our lives. We're stuck with what's familiar to us, even if it's unwholesome. It's comfortable. And somehow we need to resolve to step away from the familiar situation and see what else is out there in the wide world, to broaden our perspectives, to see what else we can be doing with our lives, to really engage with our lives and not be stuck. Sometimes it's a good friend who will give us a nudge to challenge us to look at things from a fresh perspective. And somehow we need to muster the strength to make the effort to change and not live with the status quo. That even if we get a nudge from somebody, the strength and the effort, we have to find it within ourselves. Only we can do that. So this is a little poem that really exemplifies that Susan Nelson shared with me when she was in La Crosse a few years ago. And it's called Autobiography in Five Short Chapters by Portia Nelson. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. Isn't that wonderful? I love that poem. I can make copies if people want it later. So, okay. So, can we take responsibility for ourselves and give ourselves space to grow and change, to be fluid and not hold on so tightly to our own sense of identity? Norman speaks a lot about the stories we tell to create our own personas. If we can draw upon our past experiences to help us embrace the present moment, we can just be with whatever comes up. If we expect our present to be just like the past, we're stuck and we suffer, because conditions are constantly changing. Nothing and no one will ever be exactly the same twice. We can never count on things to be constant, even our own bodies and minds. This can be a source of feeling totally alone. But when we can experience this aloneness and not lose our balance, we've awakened to the reality of life and we realize we're all in the same boat, alone together. We can recognize our own suffering and face it. So, back to the Odyssey a little bit here. So, while Telemachus is out on his journey, Odysseus is struggling to get home. He encounters many obstacles on his journey home. From Cyclops, who ate many of his crew, to the sirens who seduced them, to a goddess who fell in love with him and wouldn't let him go. Many of the obstacles on his journey were of his own making. For example, after spearing Cyclops in the eye and escaping with his crew, he felt the need to taunt the Cyclops. The Cyclops then cursed him, praying to his father Poseidon, who was kind of the god of the sea. And, you know, since he was trying to get around in a ship, that wasn't that easy. That wasn't a good enemy to have. So Cyclops prayed to his father Poseidon to prevent Odysseus' safe return. I'm sorry. But if it couldn't be prevented, then for Odysseus to come home late and in bad shape, with the loss of all his companions in someone else's ship, and find troubles in his household when he arrived home. Well, that kind of really sums up all the obstacles that were created from Odysseus because of his need to get the last word in and taunt the Cyclops. But in the midst of all his struggles, he was one-pointed about wanting to get home to Ithaca to be with his wife and his son. He never gave up his determination to get home, and I have home with a capital H. So if we can all recognize the desire that we all have to live with us, we all have to live with the desire we have to live with a sense of well-being, perhaps we can summon the strength to practice and uncover the reality of our lives. This is called bodhicitta, arousing the way-seeking mind. It's our determined effort that can sustain each of us to live in a wholesome way. So that I wanted to read, I think, is this on, did you guys get bulletins this morning? Oh, okay. That Kimberly had asked me what I wanted on the front of the bulletin. So, okay. So, when Shakyamuni Buddha was dying, he had this to say. As the Buddha was dying, Ananda asked, "Who would be their teacher after death?" He replied to his disciple, "Be lamps unto yourselves, be refuges unto yourselves. Take yourself no external refuge. Hold fast to the truth as a lamp, hold fast to the truth as a refuge. Look not for a refuge in anyone besides yourself. And those, Ananda, who either now or after I am dead shall be a lamp unto themselves, shall betake themselves as no external refuge, but holding fast to the truth as their lamp, holding fast to the truth as their refuge, shall not look for refuge to anyone else besides themselves. It is they who shall reach the very topmost height, but they must be anxious to learn." So, we all have to do this alone together. What time is it, Dan? Is it really early? Okay. So, this is what my talk was, and maybe I can, we can have some commentary and questions, and then there's something else I want to say after that.
Susan, it seems interesting that your example of not receiving something that you want is missing the eggs and potatoes at the retreat. Your practice must be going very well.
Well, I could have given some some more intimate things, I'm sure, but I was trying to keep this a little light, you know? So, I really did want those eggs and potatoes, so I'll tell you.
Even with an example like that, I think the being able to see it happening, especially while it's happening, you know, when you first try it, like 2 days later, you figure out, boy, I was talking, wasn't I? Usually I see my husband.
Yeah.
So I think that's something, to be able to see it while it's happening.
I think so, that we need to train ourselves that way to see those things as they come up more and more so that we can turn on a dime.
You tend to be able to see better than others.
Absolutely. Isn't that funny? And our spouses particularly, don't you think? I think my husband, Dwayne, is one of my best teachers. He tells me all the time what I need to do to improve myself. And sometimes I try to share that opportunity with him, and he's not very happy.
I'm curious, this maybe is a tangential question, but the Odyssey is an extremely brutal story.
Mm-hmm.
And Odysseus is an incredibly violent and vengeful man. And I'm just curious whether that's something that Norm Fisher... I mean, I think it is a beautiful and amazing story also, with a lot to teach about what it is to be human. But I'm wondering if Norm Fisher just sort of doesn't address that, or whether he looks at that in this book.
I think he addresses it, but he doesn't focus on it very much. That that I think he looks at it too as culturally as a sign of the times of when the Odyssey was written, but and it's been a little bit of a long time since I read the end of the book, Ben, so I can't completely answer that question. So, yeah, it's kind of an oxymoron, because there's all kinds of things that Odysseus does that are really beautiful, and when he gets back together with his wife after all that bloodshed, it's just a really beautiful moment. But, you know, there's all that other stuff. So maybe that's all the stuff that we need to clear away in our own minds before we can get to that beauty. No other comments?
It occurred to me that maybe Jerry Garcia would have a little commentary on that when he said he saw instructions for a long, strange trip to go.
You want to sing that a little?
No.
It's funny you sing it than I sing it.
can add two more sources of suffering. One is getting what you want and finding out that it wasn't what you thought. And the second is avoiding something that you don't want and then realizing later that it was a lot of suffering.
So that was getting what you want, and realizing it's something you really don't want, and then avoiding something you don't want and realizing it's a missed opportunity. Thank you.
Being upright and out of balance, and, you know, how do you know if you're supposed to be falling in the hole or catching it, or you know, how do you be? Out of chapter 6 would be gathering a team and catching the hole. What is that?
Well, I think oftentimes that we have more than one choice. And I think that she's looked at the hole and she's seen the patching that needs to be done. That she's falling in and it's a habit and her eyes are open. And that she knows where she is. And perhaps seeing that that's not a hole she wants. She doesn't need to be in a hole anymore. I think that's the point. She doesn't have to fall into the hole. And so the hole is kind of an unwholesome place to be. And so she's able to muster the strength to not go back in that hole and walk around it. To make the effort to see what's down another street that could be more wholesome. And I think it's about just realizing that where I'm happy with how things are, and it's time to see what else is there. And I think we all kind of, it happens organically, and we all kind of know when that we all have lots of holes to fall in and dig ourselves out. Without our holes, we don't become the people we are. Without the suffering we go through and our attachment to things, and looking at that, we don't grow, we don't mature.
I'm thinking it takes some discernment to know when to walk down the other street and when to gather the crew and patch up the hole. You know, maybe sometimes if we think that we have to do something, that might not be balanced in some circumstance.
So this is actually a good segue that I think many of the people I wanted to say this to are here today, but they'll be able to listen to this. But I wanted to talk a little bit about a transition that I'm making, and being a little bit of a different road to go down. That I'm in the midst of this transition right now, that I'm stepping away from being a formal student, being in a formal student-teacher relationship with Tim. That in late November, that Tim made a suggestion to me to consider practicing with Dokai.
working with a teacher at Hatha Yoga. And at first I was kind of taken back by this. But when I considered it more fully, it just seems the right direction to go in, the right road to take. Beginning with Shakyamuni, when he was wandering around India trying to find the truth of life, he practiced with a number of different teachers until he finally sat down under that tree by himself to try to awaken his own spirit. So the monks have practiced from then to now under the guidance of different teachers. Sometimes the relationship has just run its course and it's time to move on. My friend Joan spoke to me about this being beyond me or Tim or Dokai, and sometimes the universe just needs to realign itself. And the purpose of this realignment is how to best manifest Buddha's way. So I really appreciate the guidance and care that Tim has given me the last 6 years, that I think at this time it'll be beneficial for me to have a primary teacher who is able to see me from a different perspective. I'm using the word primary here because I actually feel that I have many teachers who inform my life from the Zen community and from my family members and to many other people I interact with. And what this means for me practically is that right now I'm kind of a free agent. I was thinking of a way to get in this metaphor that Lee used before, but I'm not sure how to use that. I plan to continue to do Zazen here in the mornings, but I'll also have the opportunity to take classes and participate in retreats at other centers in the area more freely. I feel a little bit like Telemachus setting sail, and I don't know where this journey will lead. I just have a deep faith that it will be all okay. And I have a really deep appreciation and affection for this community, and my intention is to still be a participant in the life of this Sangha. If anybody has any questions about this, they can talk to me or talk to Tim when he gets back. I'd appreciate there not being a lot of triangulation around this. But both Tim and I are really committed to staying really good friends, but just in a different way.